With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for joining me, Jake Cunningham, for another Curzon Film Podcast. I'm sat at a big table. There's some Dave Brubeck playing. I'm rolling out some blueprints, and around me, I've got a Boski, a Jim Brown, a Miss Daisy, two Jethros, a Leon Spinks, not to mention the biggest Ella Fitzgerald ever, and of course, Sam Howlett and Kelly Powell. How you doing, guys?
Good.
Yep, good.
If you hadn't guessed, it's a heist film this week. It's American Animals. This is Bart Layton, the director of The Imposter, and he has once again fused together documentary and fiction film to create maybe the heist film to end all heist films. What were we thinking with this one? Our anticipation levels?
High.
Yeah?
Very high.
Yeah. Have either of you seen The Imposter?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was the BAFTA winner for documentary in 2012, which is crazy that it's 6 years ago and it took 6 years for Bart to come out for another film.
Docu-noir.
Yeah. That was a great film.
So good. That's one of those films where I can remember the cinema that I was in when I was watching it.
Oh, really?
I really loved that one. Shout out to the Electric Palace in Hastings.
It's still open.
It's still going.
Oh, good.
Yeah. And we've actually got an interview with Bart that Kelly, you were lucky enough to sit down and talk through American Animals, and we'll be going through that later. But how would we describe American Animals? Because it is a tough one. Well, I went to a Q&A with Bart, and he emphatically said afterwards, "This is not a documentary." Yes, it's not. But I mean, the amount of press that is covering that angle, it slightly is.
It's a
it's peppered with documentary elements,
a light,
I guess. Light smattering.
A sprinkle.
Yeah.
It's similar to what he did with The Imposter in a way, but
it mirrors each other, because I think The Imposter is definitely a documentary, but it's got quite a heavy fictional element in terms of like the reenactment and the way that he puts the narrative together. Whereas this one, I think it's definitely a narrative film or a fiction film, but I think that it's heavily influenced by documentary elements.
The opening title is "This is not based on a true story," and then the "not" fades out.
I asked him about that.
Yeah. Oh well, I look forward to hearing that. And it's, I think, to me, that when I watch the film, it's not necessarily a true story, but it's based on truths and subjective truths. And I think that's what I think is really interesting about the film, and something that Bart plays a lot with. And it's obviously really interested in when you think of The Imposter and the roots that goes down as well. So just to give some background on the film, Bart takes the heist movie into bold new territory with the unbelievable but true story of four young men who attempt one of the most audacious art heists in US history. Barry Keoghan and Evan Peters play two friends from the middle-class suburbs of Lexington, Kentucky, who upon enrolling in college realize that their lives may in fact never be important or special in any way. Determined to live lives that are out of the ordinary, they plan the brazen theft of some of the world's most valuable books from the special collections room of the college library. Kelly, do you want to just lead us into this this interview with Bart? What can we expect to hear?
Yeah, he goes into some depth with some of his answers, which is really nice to hear his thinking and the way that he processed things and the making. I asked him a lot about like the actual making of the film, And he's just a delight to talk to, and I hope you enjoy. Bart Layton, thank you so much for joining us on the Cozen Film Podcast, and congratulations with your new film, American Animals. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was great. I thought it was a clever, multi-layered and affecting film that plays around with documentary and the so-called narrative film form. And I was just wondering a little bit about what inspired you to tell the story in that way.
Well, thanks for all of that. I guess what inspired me to tell the film in that way? Well, my background is docs. And so there's always that thing of... I guess I always have that feeling, you know, when you go into a movie and it says based on a true story at the beginning, you think, oh, okay, how much is that giving, you know, the writers and director license to kind of depart wildly from the truth? And, you know, and we all have that sort of sense that actually probably a lot of it is made up. And then you come out of the cinema and you start Googling, you know, what are these people actually like and what they really say? And with this, it was two things, really. It was one, that the story was so sort of outrageous and bizarre. And also, it was sort of a story about life imitating movies, in a way. And it didn't need a lot of exaggerating or fictionalizing. You know, it felt like I could... I didn't want to take huge artistic license with it. You know, of course, if you're writing dialogue and you're writing a screenplay, you are doing that. But at the same time, I wanted it to be really clear to the audience that this isn't just based on the true story. It is a true story, and it and what you're going to see is real. And that it felt to me that because so much of what the crime was about was not just about, you know, the money and... it was about these rather lost young men who'd been raised on an expectation that their lives were going to be a certain way and that they were going to be special and interesting and important and actually get to a place where they, you know, like most of us do, where they're realizing that probably, you know, they're not going to be special or interesting or important. And... but they're desperately searching for that, you know, some way in which to leave a mark on the world. And I felt like their voices were almost an essential part of the telling of the story, you know, that that without them, it would be a much more disposable story. You know, it would be a fun ride, you know, it would be a great caper and a, you know, a fun heist and an unconventional one, given... that, you know, it's not a bank, it's a library, and it's not, you know, millions of dollars, it's the rarest books in the world and all of that stuff. And so it was really like just thinking, how can we elevate this story to a place where you as an audience experience it in a completely different way? You know, you have an emotional investment in the story and the characters that I don't think you get from, you know, a normal... kind of based on a true story type thing.
Yeah, it definitely adds another dynamic to it, and you kind of, it pulls you into the story in a very different way, which I thought was super clever. So I'm actually very interested about how you shot it and what your process was once you decided to make the film. Did you interview the real men first and get their testimonials and shoot their testimonials before
the
screenplay?
So it was a really unconventional process, and most, and like, you know, there wasn't really a template for how you do something like this, because I guess, you know, it hadn't been done before, which was good on one level, but it also makes it really like risky, and you know, no one knows whether they should invest in something like that or how to schedule it. Or so the process was that because when I started writing the script, the real guys were in prison, and so we would write letters back and forth, and I was working with my co-producer Poppy, who I worked with on The Imposter, and you know, and I sent her down to meet with them in prison, and she visited them and did an interview, and then we would take those letters and the interviews And I would write the screenplay around that, around the things that they had said. Okay. And then when they eventually came out of prison, we went and shot the... So I got the film financed based on the script, which had...
So you wrote the screenplay first?
I wrote the screenplay first with what I expected them to say, based on stuff that they'd already said in letters and phone calls and all that.
All right.
And then when we sat down to shoot the interviews with them after they came out of prison, you know, they said a lot of what I'd expect them to say, but they didn't say a lot of it. And they also said a lot of other stuff that, so I was like, oh, crap, you know, how, you know, I've sold the screenplay. But of course, the thing you don't want to do is try and get real people to perform, you know.
Exactly, yeah.
You don't want that to try and turn them into actors, because then the thing that they are there to do, which is to provide a kind of a level of authenticity,
yeah,
and this quite striking note of reality, I guess, you know, that evaporates if you're trying to get them to give lines or
exactly.
And it, you know, and at one point, you know, I was saying, yeah, you did say this before, would you say that again? And then I just realized, you know, actually, you know, what we've got to do is go back to just how you would shoot this as a normal doc and start the interview at the beginning and go all the way through it. And so then I had to phone the producers. Yeah, not back to the drawing board, but a little bit. And I had to phone the producers and say, look, you know what? I need to rewrite the script, not around what I expect them to say, but actually around what they have said. And some of it is going to be, it's going to make it way better. Okay. I wasn't sure it would, but yeah. I think actually in the end it did. It okay. ended up more poignant and yeah. more emotional. And
Yeah. And so did you storyboard like super intensively, or did a lot of it come together in the edits?
No, I'm really like, partly because I'd never really made a kind of fiction film before. Yeah. And I was felt very, you know, out of my depth, you know, like I didn't have that experience. And it was also a real, you know, no one stopped telling me like what an ambitious screenplay it was, even for like a really, you know, I even sat down with Danny Boyle at one point and he was like, wow, okay, you've really picked like an ambitious first film. And and so I felt kind of terrified about showing up and not really having enough of a plan. So I did. I storyboarded, you know, the whole thing. Not with even with a view to really showing anyone.
Okay.
I showed a few things to my cinematographer, but no, it was more just to have a real sense of how it was going to flow.
Yeah.
And rhythmically as well. It's very much, you know, there's a real specific kind of rhythmic ebb and flow to the movie, you know.
Yeah.
So part of what I want to do is make sure that, you know, I know that I'm going from quiet to loud, or I'm going from dark to light, or I'm going from close to wide, and you know that as you know that the transitions in the movie are quite complicated as well. And so I spent a long time with a guy called Temple Clark who's a brilliant kind of collaborator. He's more than just a storyboarder, he's just someone we, you know, and we talk the whole film through.
Wow. Yeah. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Okay. I wanted to ask specifically about your tongue-in-cheek use of titles in the film.
Mm-hmm.
What do titles sort of represent, and like why did you choose to play around with them in that way, coming from a dark background?
So you mean captions and captions, you know, like, yeah. Well, I guess this comes back to, you know, that thing we were talking about at the beginning, about that idea that, you know, we walk into the cinema and say, this is based on a true story, and then you're like, okay, based on, what does that mean? Like, how based on is it? And so the movie starts with this caption that says, this is not based on a true story. And then that
fades away.
Fades away, and you get, this is a true story. And that, again, is like, to try and make sure that it's like, okay, wake up, we're not gonna, you know, we you know, it's kind of fun, but it's also sort of making a point that this is very close to the truth, and we're gonna have, when the real people show up, you know, I mean, even, you know, I've had a lot of Q&As in mainly in the States, where people still put up their hand at the end of the movie and say, are the real guys the real guys? And it does say over them, the real Spencer, the real Warren, you know. And I guess it's partly because they look kind of handsome and they're very charismatic that you kind of think, well, are they actors as well? So I guess some of that was intended to be sort of ironic, and some of it was just intended to make sure that, you know, because even with The Imposter, a load of people thought The Imposter was a complete work of fiction, you know, and even though it was a doc. So it was to try and curb some. And then, you know, there are a few places where, again, you know, I mean, you can tell me more specifically the bits you're referencing, but I guess, you know, part of the captions are, I guess, like most of the devices in the movie, are intended to pull you back into the reality of that this really happened. Yeah. You know, it's like, I know it feels a lot like a movie, but this, what you're seeing actually happened, and and if you remember that, then you're going to be more, you're going to lean in a bit more, and you're going to be like, oh, where is this actually going to end?
Yeah,
and you sort of feel like you're a bit more. You're able to participate a little bit more in it.
I think the one that sort of got me was the double use of, I mean, I don't want to give anything away.
The day of the robbery.
Yeah, the day of the robbery. Kind of like, you know, it's a, it's just a clever way of like sort of reminding you, like, oh, okay. It kind of makes you conscious of what's going on. And
yeah, there was a bit of debate about that. I thought it was fun because, you know, and it, you know, we don't want to spoil it for people, but I guess, you know, there are two days of the robbery, and it sort of felt like it was sort of a way, I guess it was a way of kind of nodding at the, not the incompetence of the protagonist, but about the fact that that they
kids, you know,
that they didn't really have a plan, you know, that just so it's sort of like in the spirit of sort of how ridiculous it all is, I guess.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. I just wanted to ask, you know, with The Imposter as well as this film, it seems like you have a focus on your protagonist's sort of search for and construction of identity.
Definitely.
What is important about that subject matter for you?
Oh God, I mean, it's a really good question. I mean, I think this is a different, this is different from The Imposter. You know, there a lot of, you know, you're absolutely right. You know, The Imposter was absolutely about, you know, identity, but it was, and it was about, you know, it was a con man story, so it was about deception. But it was probably more, to my mind, it was more about self deception in a way. You know, what are the lies that we need to believe in a way? With this, I feel like we are in increasingly in a culture where our identities are sort of constructed or caught up in, they're sort of defined by the way other people see us, you know, that we, that we, you know, that that everyone is broadcasting constant, you know, we have our Twitter accounts and our Instagram accounts and our, you know, Snapchat, whatever it is, and, you know, and I watch, you know, particularly recently, you know, being, having spent quite a bit of time in America, you know, I really watched, you know, these teenagers living, not really experiencing anything, but wanting to wanting to video it all and then make sure that everyone knows that everyone saw it and that everyone knows that they're at this hip place with these other gorgeous people, and that, you know, and I've seen so much of this sense that our self-esteem and our idea of ourselves is all caught up in how much we need other people to perceive us a certain way, and that we're not necessarily thinking this is who I am, and this is, like, you know, this is what I want to do for me. We need to we need other people to kind of think we're, you know, fabulous, and in order to feel fabulous ourselves, I guess. And so with this, a lot of what I felt was driving the crime was this sense that these guys needed, they didn't want it, there was a huge pressure just to not be ordinary.
Yeah.
You know, not to be a nobody.
Yeah.
And it almost doesn't matter what you're leaving, why you're leaving a mark on the world, whether it's a good mark or a bad mark, as long as you're a somebody. You know, I was interviewed by a journalist, a really young college journalist in Seattle recently, and she said, you know, there's a real, she said the film hit home so much for her and her friends because there's a real sense that, you know, if we don't have a Wikipedia page written about us by the time we're 40, will that mean that we're not successful? Yeah. And so success, that idea of success, I think in our culture has really shifted, you know, from, you know, like what these kids' parents had, which was nice car, nice house, all of that.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what the American dream
security
used to be.
Security and,
Whereas now, it's so much about, you know, fame, and fame seems very reachable, I think. Yeah. You know, it seems so much more tangible than I think it probably did, you know, when I was a kid.
That's almost the goal, you know, rather
than, and that idea, you know, that's why, you know, the strap line on the poster is nobody wants to be ordinary, and I think that's a big part of what the crime was about, and ultimately for me it's a big part of what the movie's about.
Yeah, I know I'm being cheeky because we've run out of time, but this is a question that I really wanted to ask you. Art and expression through art in whatever form that it might take seems to play it's very, you know, thematically significant in your film. And so I wanted to ask, you know, on many levels, but I wanted to ask what the role of art plays in the film, the story, and also in the lives of the people that you portray.
Yeah, God, these are good questions, and they're not easy to answer quickly. You know, it's something I think about a lot because, you know, both my parents were artists and, my dad still is. And, there is that question, you know, part of what's driving Spencer, who's the lead character in the film, you know, he wants to be an artist, but he's like, you know, my life is just too nice. What am I ever going to have? You know, every artist he's ever read about has had trauma and suffering and some kind of, you know, tragedy in their childhood. And he's thinking, well, I can paint pretty pictures brilliantly, which he can, but how am I actually going to become an artist? And I think, you know, he's longing for this life experience that's going to qualify him to make art. And I think, you know, something I think about is, my mum was a painter and a theatre director. She didn't really think about the audience a whole lot. She had to just create art and express. Whereas I guess I'm much more caught up in the need for people to see it and like it, and, you know, and with that comes that question of, well, is that art? If, you know, isn't art just something that you just have to kind of put, you know, you have to express this idea or this thing, you know? Whereas you know, does that make you a lesser artist? And, you know, so I think, you know, and I think one of the things that I wanted to include the artwork from Audubon, you know, the book that they steal, is this incredible work of art. And one of the things that Spencer envies about Audubon is that he also grew up in Kentucky, or spent time in Kentucky, but he went off into the wilderness and sort of found himself and had this purpose of painting every bird in America. And Spencer, he hasn't found that purpose. He hasn't had his time in the wilderness to figure out who he is and find out his voice and his art. And I guess all of that comes back to your question of identity. You know, can you be an artist if you don't really have suffering, or if you haven't found out who you are and all the rest of it,
and what you want to say, I guess.
And actually, you know, they, you know, his trip into the wilderness became this robbery, and you know, I guess it's up to audiences to try and think about, you know, whether it delivered the thing that they wanted it to deliver, or whether it left them right back where they started.
Before we get shouted at, I think I'm going to end it and say thank you very much.
Oh, total pleasure.
Have you got anything else in the pipeline that we can look forward to?
So the next thing will be, you know, it's not a true story, but it almost could have been. And there's a kind of, and it's also, it's a sort of dark, twisted, slightly comic thriller, also set in the South, deep South. And there's
American,
whole,
hey? Yeah, American, yeah, American focus.
I don't know why. Probably watching too many American movies. And there's a whole kind of Trumpian sort of overtone to the story. You know, it's about a charlatan who people don't want to believe is a charlatan, sort of thing.
Okay, awesome. I look forward to it.
Selling a little or a lot?
Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Okay, so that was Bart Layton talking about American Animals. If you've got anything you want to say about American Animals, don't forget to, you can email us at podcast@curzon.com and we can read those out in future episodes of the show. I think there's a lot to talk about with this one, so we'd be really interested to hear what you listeners are thinking. But what are you guys thinking? I've had a couple of days now to mull it over, but you've had months to maybe mull it over as well, or a few weeks.
Yeah, we were at the same press screening.
Yeah.
I think initially... You liked it a lot more than I did. But I think over time I've thought more about it and it's settled in a nice place in my brain now, in what I think it is and what I think it's doing.
I walked out very excited. It's just a film, I think, that, like, say what you want about it, but it's just, it's an exciting piece of filmmaking. I think he's doing a very innovative things with narrative and form. And it's just, it was just, I was on the edge of my seat the whole time, you know, like he just keeps you,
he's fantastic at ramping up tension, stakes, really.
So good.
Twisting and turning in every way that you'd want a heist movie to go.
Yeah, exactly.
But because it's bringing that edge of the subjective truth and his form really changes as well.
Yeah.
It's fantastic. So let's take it back to the start of this story. We've got Barry Keoghan and Evan Peters. They're our key characters. Evan plays Warren Lipka and Barry plays Spencer Reinhardt. Warren is... kind of maybe the loose cannon of this one. He's your Brad Pitt, maybe. he's laid back, charismatic, nothing kind
unpredictable.
He is, but he just has the complete confidence that they will pull it off. And then Barry Keoghan, Spencer Reinhardt, he is a young art student. He gets disillusioned by his college life and just needs to inject something in it that's gonna maybe give them the excitement that they didn't actually get or they feel like they need in life to become special.
Well, yeah, I think Bart goes into this in the interview, as you just heard, but it's that feeling of like, how can I be an artist and not have lived a life to say something worth saying, you know? So I think that's where Spencer's sort of motivations came from.
Yeah, and it was quite nice to see Barry Keoghan, like, in my head he is just killing of a sacred deer.
Creepy kid.
Yeah, and in this he's not actually that creepy at all.
Yeah. Oh, he's so likable.
Yeah, well, as is quote the real Spencer Reinhardt. So it's not only we've got the characters of Warren Lipka and Spencer Reinhardt, we have Warren Lipka and Spencer Reinhardt and the other members of the team, Chaz Allen, Eric Borsuk. And what is great about these documentary sections, in inverted quotes, is that they are, rather than give them their name, they say the real, which just by adding that makes you question all of that as well.
Yeah.
Constantly, you're unaware of what you really, how much salt you're taking with every shot of this film.
And they all contradict each other as well. Mm. Like, is it the guy they meet in Amsterdam? He's sometimes an old man and sometimes
Udo Kier.
Yeah. But I know the guy that he meets, like when he first described him, it was like an old man. And then when the other guy described him, no, it was a young man, a young guy in a suit or something.
Oh, it's in New York. I think they go to New York. New York.
And they keep changing what they remember, where they had the first conversations, who said that first, who had that first idea.
What location they were in. That's so...
I think this brings into what is the... Out of all the craft on show in the film, I think it's the editing that is what brings it all together. It snaps along. It's fantastic. Like, there's so much energy to it. He knows when to amp it up. He knows when to slow it down. And that ties into how the camera moves around and his understanding of genre convention and when to bring in traditional documentary elements like handheld camera, reducing that sound. He even takes the for the documentary elements, the sound is in mono, so it's coming straight at you. But in the more fantasy genre elements, it's surround sound. And it's got this constant contrast but this contrast of kind of fantasy and reality and always blending it. So these chaps, they're bored, they're entitled middle class white kids in America, and they need to inject something into their life, so they decide to steal these books from the library, which are worth up to, I think it's mentioned, about $12 million. And in doing so, they decide to watch endless heist films and plan out the ultimate heist. And then that's where I think Bart starts to have a lot of fun with it. And that's when you can see that this is his love letter to this genre. And that's when it really clicked in for me. I texted you afterwards, after I saw this, saying, like, how can there be heist films after American Animals, after it's deconstructed it so well? What did you think about when it moves into more of that? It's not like, I suppose Tarantino would be a touchstone of that genre mimicry, homage.
Well, I think, for me, one of the most interesting things about a film that I've realised more after seeing it is that these guys are toxic fanboys. They're fanboys that have taken this genre, this cultural thing they like, way too seriously, and all they do is watch it and think, that's cool, I want to do that. I don't think what they do out of spite or out of being bad people. I think what they do is out of A, boredom, and B, they want their lives to be a movie. And they just completely misinterpret every single heist film and then apply that to their own lives.
That's interesting you say that, because I think they do interpret them. I think they interpret them as exactly the message that they put out there. And I think what American Animals is about is it's someone pining after a genre and having to reconcile with its flaws. And it's like...
I think they realise too late the problem
Of
being in a heist film. Most heist films don't end well for the heisters. The Oceans films do. They're very glamorized in the heisting. But
I think it's interesting you say that. I think that you're right. They want to live out this fantasy, this movie. They want to be the lead characters in a movie. Surprise, surprise, they are. But I think that where it becomes interesting for me, particularly, is the sort of conflict between that fantasy world and how it translates into reality and the real consequences that actions in real life have on real people, basically.
And this is what I think it is fantastic, when it takes what in so many other heist films is a throwaway moment, and in this turns it into the moment that they step over the line. Like, take any heist film, there's probably going to be a moment where some security guy
gets pulled into a closet and then they walk out wearing their clothes.
And then it's that moment that changes these guys. And they realize that they to steal the books, there's a nice librarian played by Ann Dowd. Always unsettling to see Ann Dowd being nice, but she has to be taken out of the situation. And so they have a taser and bind her, and it's really horrible scene to watch.
Even the lead up to that, they are kind of like, nobody wants to do it.
And you think, how often have we seen that scene take place and it's completely glossed over? There's no one's thinking about consequences or pain or trauma or anything like that. And you can see in the performances of the guys, when that moment happens, they regret it instantly. And then in the form of the film, all the way up to the heist, you've got these long dolly shots. It's really smooth. It's cut to the music. It's really rhythmic. It's seductive. And then the moment that they take her down, it changes. We're back in handheld documentary. And it's exhausting.
And everything starts to sort of unravel for them. Yeah.
Yeah. The heist, without going into too much detail, the heist goes really badly wrong. But like, it's not like Reservoir Dogs where it's just chaos and there are people getting killed and everything's unfolding. It's just like embarrassing. It goes embarrassingly wrong.
There are people
dropping things and like scrambling around and like the lift goes, you know, and like people throwing up. And
I think it's in that
kids.
In those moments, they're real people. I think he's so clever in the way that he does it. Is like he takes you completely out of the fantasy zone and puts you straight back into. Even though it's part of the genre, the narrative part of the movie, you feel like they're just real people.
I haven't heard the interview yet, but in terms of the editing as well, we've talked about this blending of the documentary footage of the real guys and the actors. At the start of the film, you're almost 50-50 between the actors and the real guys. And then gradually, over the first two-thirds of the film, it reduces and reduces, and we're more in the world of the actors. So we, like the guys, have become immersed in the fantasy, and we've got trapped in it. Exactly. We've almost forgotten about the real world.
Yeah.
And then it's that snap. It's that back to reality, and then we see Spencer.
A true story.
We see Spencer, the real Spencer. We see the real Warren. And we think, oh God, you did this.
Yeah.
You actually did this horrible thing.
And it's got this interesting thing of they always wanted their lives to be a movie, and now it is.
Yeah.
But they're not really the heroes of the movie.
Exactly, yeah.
They're just kind of.
Oh, this movie's so multi-layered. I love it.
They're just kind of. It ends with them kind of in a kind of pathetic sort of place.
Yeah.
But you know, they're
well, I don't think that's a bit harsh. I think you because of the way that it's done and because he takes you step by step through the way that they rationalized it and you know, all throughout, you know, I think that he makes Bart Layton makes you like these guys and sympathize with these guys as well, but recognize that they did something wrong and they themselves do as well. So you kind of go through the same sort of cycle that they've almost done themselves. You know, you come to realize that like they are extremely remorseful for what, not to say that they did that it's right or okay that they did what they did, but I think they know that, you know. And I think it's good that he shows that sort of arc.
And I think that ties into Bart's own reconciliation with this genre. That I think that this story comes up, you've got to immerse yourself in it, you've got to realize its flaws, you've got to see the damage that it could potentially do. And you think so many of those other films will get to that traumatic point, that bit where these guys cross the line, and it highlights to you how in so many other films the line's not even there, it's not even addressed. I think it's really fantastic. And what is great to hear is that Betty Jean, who is the librarian who suffered at the hands of these men, she loves the film as well.
She
was the main person that he wanted the blessing of before showing the film to anyone. Took it round to her house. They sat down and watched it with her husband. Her husband was asleep within 20 minutes. Just found it a bit boring. And it's the least boring film. It's one of the least boring films of the year. That's American Animals. And that's in cinemas this Friday. Do make sure you go and check it out. I mentioned the stuff about the mono and the surround sound and things like that. I think that tells you how much Bart is thinking of this as a cinema release. So please go and watch it on a big screen. It looks amazing as well. So it's Ulla Birkeland, and he's actually shot The Little Stranger, which is out in a couple of weeks as well. Really great cinematographer. However, you maybe don't fancy the cinema this weekend. If you wanted to stay in and watch something on Curzon Home Cinema, maybe you could watch something there. Sam, what's out?
Cold War. Just watch Cold War.
Yeah,
it's really, really good. We did the show on it last week, and we spoke to Joachim Kulig and Thomas Kott. And they're incredible in it. The film's incredible. Watch Cold War.
And it will take up 84 minutes of your life.
Exactly. You could watch it twice.
And that is, so that's available, American Animals in cinemas, but it's not the only thing in cinemas this weekend as well. There's another film called The Miseducation of Cameron Post, and we love it so much we've done another episode of this podcast as well. We've doubled up for you. And so we've got an interview for that as well.
With writer-director Desiree Akhavan.
Yes.
And so that will be, depending on whether you've listened to this one first or whether that one first, go and listen
to that
one.
It's like Jack Reacher. It's like the Jack Reacher books. There's no chronological order. Just pick and choose as you go along. Yeah. It's fine.
So remember, if you've got any thoughts on American Animals or Cold War even, or the Miseducation of Cameron Post even.
Or anything!
Email them to podcast@curzon.com for next week's show. Next week, we're going to be talking about Lucky, that's starring Harry Dean Stanton in his final role, and directed by everyone's favourite, that guy I recognise, John Carroll Lynch. So make sure you check that out. And one final thing to mention, Open City Doc Fest has started. That's a citywide celebration of the art of non-fiction, very relevant to this week's show. We're lucky enough to be showing a few of the films at the Bertha Doc House screen at our Bloomsbury site, as well as six films at Curzon Soho across this weekend. The one that I'm really interested in is Golden Dawn Girls. This is about the women who stepped up to lead the far-right Golden Dawn Party in Greece when the party's leaders were put behind bars. It's from a Norwegian director called Havard Busnes, and he'll be about for a Q&A. That's on Saturday night. Check out the rest of the programme as well. And, actually, there's a new Curzon magazine out, isn't there, Sam?
There is indeed. Bohemian Rhapsody is on the front cover.
Yep.
And there's also a feature in there about an upcoming release.
Yeah, who's written that release?
I don't know. Maybe me.
Yeah,
it is me.
Yep.
Yeah, I've written a piece about the bad times at the El Royale, which is Drew Goddard's latest film. He, of course, is the writer and director of Cabin in the Woods. So, very interested indeed. It's basically me wondering what the film might be about because I haven't actually seen it.
But you are excited about it.
I'm very excited about it. Yeah, it looks very fun. Bad times at the El Royale.
Brilliant. So that's it for this week's show. Make sure you subscribe on iTunes or Acast or wherever you get your podcasts. Leave us a review or a comment as well. That would be wonderful. And you can keep up with us on Twitter. You can follow Kelly at
KS_Powell.
Sam at
SamHowlett_1.
And me at Jake H. Cunningham. Until then, it's bye from me and we'll go back around. Bye from Kelly.
Ciao.
And bye from Sam.
Bye from Sam.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.